Hi, it's Lucy, and welcome back to another episode of The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I put a spotlight on the talented women working in cinema. Today, I'm joined by an incredible guest, BAFTA and Oscar-nominated costume designer Linda Muir. You may know her stunning work from films like The Witch and The Northman, and now she's been recognised for her extraordinary designs in Robert Eggers' Nosferatu. Linda's ability to craft rich, immersive worlds through costume is truly unmatched, and I can't wait to hear all about her creative process. We'll be talking about everything from historical research to collaborating with directors and bringing characters to life through fabric and texture. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy today's interview with Linda Muir. Hi Linda, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I guess I'll just get started, but I heard you were doing another interview, so I guess like you're already in interview mode, so that's good. And congratulations on your recent nominations for a BAFTA in costume design and of course an Oscar. That must be really exciting, and I think it's the first...
Very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, really overwhelming, I can imagine. Just sort of, you know, I guess you're just doing your job, and then that's like a bonus, isn't it? You know, when you get some sort of recognition like that, it must feel great.
Well, we're so isolated when we're working away and so focused on the material, and then when there is such unbelievable love shown for the film, it's very, very satisfying and very rewarding for sure.
Yeah, and a moment where you can sort of put your feet up for 5 seconds and be like, just enjoy the fruits of your labor, as they say. So for my podcast, I usually like to start out my episode by sort of really going right back to the beginning with my guest and, you know, asking what you were like as a child and what you were like, what it was like for you growing up. You know, were you always drawn to art and fashion and costumes from a young age, or is that something that came about a little bit later?
I wouldn't say that I was drawn to fashion so much, but definitely playing. I was very fortunate in that my parents, you know, we were left to play, and we had a playhouse in our home in the basement, and it was like a slightly child-sized version of playhouse.
Yeah.
And in that there was a wooden chest of things, and my mother, we had dresses from my mother, who they would have been from the 30s, some of them would have been from the 40s, and one of my favorite was a pale blue sort of tulle and chiffon extravaganza, strapless, you know, kind of dress and matching shoes. Mm. I mean, obviously they were huge, but I absolutely loved those. And I remember the colors of those as if I was playing with them yesterday. So, well, for whatever reason, I definitely had a connection with imaginary play, you know, and I think that then I was more drawn through primary school and secondary school. I was more drawn to reading until I had a theater arts class, and then I thought, plays, oh my God, this is extraordinary. This is understanding people, humanity, you know, situations, just everything in the world of, well, I guess psychology as seen through characters. Found that, you know, in situations where everyone is involved in play is either at one point, you know, acting or directing or doing whatever, you know, in progression of plays throughout a year or a season, whatever, community theater as well when I was very, very young. I found that, you know, the acting was fine, but I certainly did not have what the extraordinary actors that I have worked with throughout my career, their ability to go there and to understand and to portray is beyond belief for me. What I have found that I enjoy is to figure out how to portray characters' emotions, a character's understanding, beliefs, whatever, through costuming, through their choices, you know, and that means reading about any given period and figuring out, because working with Robert Eggers, the writer-director of Nosferatu, and I've worked with Robert now since 2014, and, you know, so we have done what I find incredible films, and they are all set in the deep past, and The Northman, which is a Viking epic, all of these scripts require trying to have an understanding of the societies that they are portraying, and then of the choices, thinking of the costuming more as clothing and trying to think of that clothing in these different periods and what choices would these characters make, either through necessity or through the society, what that tells us about a queen, mm-hmm. like the Nicole Kidman character, for instance, in The Northman. Or, you know, what is the code of tablet weaving? What is the code of embroidery in a small mm-hmm. village, you know, 945 AD? Or when it's the deep past, it's taking the cues from statues, from carvings, from paintings, cave paintings, or whatever. You know, it's mm-hmm. they're not photographs, they're not runway looks, you know, they're not anything that is immediately accessible. So the research is so wonderful.
Pretty extensive from what I've read.
Pretty extensive. And you know, in The Northman, for instance, it was the first time that we really had the availability of scholars as and historians as a resource. And Neil Price was incredible in terms of, you know, helping. His books are on Viking life and Viking belief are astonishing. And, you know, and then to speak with Neil, to call him up and or email him and say, you know, what would make a Viking queen feel sexy?
Maybe not a question he's heard before.
Yeah, exactly. I had that question before. So, yeah, I mean, I think that over the years, you know, I think probably if somebody had asked me, what do you want to be when I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old, I probably would have said an English teacher. So,
wow. So, yes, not exactly how you imagine it to plan out, but I mean, you've made a wonderful career for yourself. So you grew up in Toronto, I believe, in Canada.
Yes.
And did you actually formally go to a costume design school or learn costume design once you...
I did not. I'm not sure whether it was a fabulous advantage or a disadvantage. I have no idea, but it certainly was what happened. At the time that I was in high school, I found it interesting enough, but I certainly didn't find it challenging. And there was, within the education system in Toronto at the time, the opportunity to go to, I mean, now they might call it a gifted school, I'm not quite sure. So we had our regular curriculum, but we also could audit university courses. So when I was, you know, quite young, I would have been, I guess, about 16. I started to audit classes, and so I would approach professors at U of T or at York University, Glendon College. My sister was in university at the time. She's 3 years older than I am. And so I, you know, had this wonderful kind of weird mix of information and accessibility. And so I found I think it was probably through one of the community theaters, actually. I had written and was directing this very odd little scene that was from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, because I think that, you know, it was Virginia Woolf, Colette, Mary Shelley, you know, they were the feminist, they were my go-to girls at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I was asked to, you know, could I attend a kind of brainstorming session, you know, what sorts of things would make education in Toronto, you know, in the arts, kind of more accessible, more interesting for younger students, that sort of thing. And at that brainstorming session, I actually met a producer who had a very small alternate theater in Toronto and said, you know, if I was ever interested in, you know, kind of pursuing that, come and have a look. And I did. And at that theater, I actually met a man named Paul Bettis, who was from Cornwall, mm-hmm. Oxford educated. And he became my mentor. He became my best friend. He became the godfather for my son. So, you know, it was... Again, like, you know, why do the stars align in the way they do? Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure happy they did.
Yeah, yeah, your paths cross for a reason.
Yeah, and so I think from a very early age, I was required to make sense of plays, scripts, characters with next to no money, you know, and evoke these things that were so, in some cases, so complicated, but, you know, and I always seemed to find a way to do it. And, mm-hmm. and so people kept asking me to do it. And so I got better at doing it.
Were you able to do that full time quite quickly then, or did you have to?
Yes. And you know, so what I started to do is I was also sewing a lot of the costumes myself. And I thought, you know, and I've always sewn. I mean, I've always sewn. And so I thought, you know, I'm sure there's some sort of standardized way of doing this. So I went and took a cutting course, and that certainly made things a lot easier, a lot faster, and it freed up. You know, I could more easily create the things that were in my head. I think I took some drawing classes, but, you know, 10,000 hours, not on your life. And so... I'm very envious of my son, who, you know, from the time he was tiny, could foreshorten and could just do things just quite naturally. For me, it takes a very long time to do my sketches. And what I have kind of realized is that that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it also means that I'm working out an awful lot in my head about how these garments are going to be constructed while I am trying to draw them and think about them. It became a bit onerous. For instance, in the Northmen, I think I did 80 odd sketches, and in Nosferatu there were quite a few because there are a lot of costumes. Mm-hmm. And it was really with the Northmen that I started working with a costume illustrator, and then on Nosferatu I worked with Sharon Smith, who is an astonishing costume illustrator, and she lives in the UK, and so we were communicating long distance. I still have to do sketches, I still have to do all the research, because obviously I'm giving her all that information to do her beautiful sketches.
So technically, you know, being a good at, you know, the sketching part of things, illustrating is not necessarily a requirement for a costume design. I mean, of course, it's good to know. I'm sure.
I think everyone has their own way of doing these things. And I think if you talked to each, you know, if you talked to several different costume designers, you would find out that each of them have a different strength. You know, it is the textiles and color, paint, you know, in terms of dyeing, breakdown, you know, the surface treatments, those are my strengths, and those are my loves, and those are my passions. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to convey that to a larger group of collaborators within the costume department, I've certainly had to, you know, get better at. But then people tell me they love my sketches because they feel like the characters, and I'm like, okay, well, great.
There you go then.
Not necessarily technically fabulous, but if that's what you feel, then I'm happy. Mm-hmm.
You know? Do you have any, like, do you remember any films or stories that sort of fascinated you when you were younger, or certain costumes that just captivated you when you saw them on screen and it kind of inspired you even more to
I started in theatre, so for the first roughly 10 or 12 years of my career, I was designing solely for theatre and alternate theatre at that for the first initial part, and then only very briefly larger theatres. And certainly, you know, people kept telling me you should be at Stratford, which is the Shakespearean Festival in Ontario, in Canada. Mm-hmm. But it sort of seemed to me that at that time, the logic to me seemed, well, they are designing things before they even know who the actors are, so the rehearsal process, which I've always held very dear, wouldn't really necessarily exist. Mm. So I resisted that for a very long time, only to find that when I was designing solely in film and television, doesn't it end up being that I'm the one that's designing everything before the actor is cast or hired?
Right.
And I'm usually the first person who actually has, or often I'm the first person who has in-depth conversations with the actors about the character and you know, convey. Not so much with Robert, because he is so hands-on with every area of his films, but certainly with other directors, you know, and certainly in series television, you know, where it's the pace is insane. Mm. You know, I ended up being the first person to say, well, you know, this is kind of the idea that we're working to with your character, and you know, these are the sorts of things that I've tried to include in your costuming. So isn't it funny the way life works, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to think how the order goes for a film or TV. Yeah, what comes first? Obviously the idea or the story, but I wouldn't have thought that. So you're saying that costume came before you even knew who the cast was? Is that what I've heard?
Oh, quite no. Frequently, for sure.
Really?
Again, not with Robert's films, because again, he is so
He's very thorough and
meticulous in all of the areas that he is dealing with. But for sure, many other films and many other television series that I've worked on, you know, there and not necessarily the leads. You know, usually if I'm reading a script, I have an idea of who they're looking at for the principal parts. But, you know, if it is a series, the cast can be 80 people, 100 people, you know, over the course of however many episodes. And, you know, in terms of, I would say that would have been less true in theater, you know, because usually the cast of a play was pretty solid by the time designers, set and costume designers are on board. Like, we may know we're doing the show, but by the time we start actually working, I know who I'm designing for. Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I had a really interesting, couple of really interesting early films, Canadian films in the 90s that were interesting for a couple of different reasons. There was in Stratford, Ontario, which again is a Shakespearean festival, and it also has a secondary theatre, and they are they produce plays that are not necessarily Shakespearean. So The Long Day's Journey Into Night was a play that was very successful at that festival, and it had the same cast, and it ran for 2 years. So consequently, those actors have played those parts for two very long full seasons to huge acclaim. And so the notion was to make that into a film. And so there was a different set designer and a different costume designer. So I designed the costumes for the film, mm-hmm. and I had not designed the costumes for the play. And we shot it in continuity because the actors had performed it for that long in mm-hmm. continuity, which is it's unheard of, really. But because it was a static set, it was less of a problem than if you were using locations. So the challenge for me was to design Long Day's Journey Into Night for actors, and the female lead that played Mary Tyrone had very specific feelings about the costumes that she had been wearing, where they hit her body, how they felt. And so not only did I have to do the period and mm-hmm. the characters, but also try to recreate in different costuming the same feeling that she'd had for 2 years.
It's a challenge.
Really fascinating. And then there was another film that one, actually, The Long Day's Journey Into Night, I think is it was part of a PBS series, and it's a really beautiful, if it's hard, I think it's hard to track down, but it's really a beautiful version. Mm-hmm. And then there was a film called Lilies, which was based on a play, a French-Canadian play. And that story was set both in the 1950s in a prison, men's prison. And those prisoners reenact the true story that happened in 1910. So back to back, I did two films set in 1910, Long Day's Journey Into Night and this film called Lilies. But Lilies, once we go into the story set in 1910, it's all portrayed by men.
Okay.
Because they're reenacting it in a prison, and mm-hmm. it becomes this fantasy. So mm. women are played by men. And so you have your I was designing 1910 women's clothing for men.
Men, yeah.
It was fascinating.
Wow. Really, yeah, because you've got to also think about, you know, their body shape and their build, which is not going to be built like a woman.
A man's 40 chest is not a woman's.
No.
it's a fascinating film to watch. And that was done, you know, on very little money mm-hmm. Budget, as was, for instance, the first film that I did with Robert, which was called The Witch, mm-hmm. in 1630. And again, you know, very high requirements for authenticity and for hand sewing and for realism, you know, but again, on a shoestring budget.
I mean, as you were saying, though, like, because Robert Eggers is so detailed and, you know, he covers all bases with everything. So I guess even if you didn't know the actors that he was planning to cast at that moment, he probably describes the characters in such detail that you can imagine it for yourself when you're going about the research and preparing.
He had cast, I believe he had cast Thomason, and maybe Kate Dickie and Ralph Ineson, but certainly he hadn't cast the children yet. They came later. And, you know, we, in lieu of historians that we would have access to at that point, Craig Lathrop, the production designer, and Robert and I went to Plymouth Plantation, which was this incredible treasure south of Boston. And it was a huge property donated by a philanthropist and buildings, separatist, you know, kind of Mayflower pilgrims, buildings from around the area had been collected, and every summer, spring through fall, they don't call them reenactors, they call them living historical folks, of course.
Okay, I'll maybe look that one up, but I'm not sure either.
and so they had so much information available, you know, in the costume department there. You know, they had been producing accurate clothing, you know, for quite a while. And so there was a wealth of information, you know, to be found there. Mm-hmm. So it comes from all over the place, depending on, you know, in reaching out, thank God for the internet, you know, reaching out when we were doing the Northmen, again, because textiles are so difficult to find, quality textiles are becoming, you know, rarer and rarer. And to find these very plain woven wools and linens or diamond patterns or half diamond and dyed in with plant dyes, you know, mm-hmm. reaching out to places in Poland and Russia and, you know, like I'd send out these emails and then just wait, you know,
and hope for something. you were saying earlier there that, you know, you didn't feel that you, compared to maybe other costume designers, that you were as good at sketching, for example. Was there, did you have any other doubts about yourself or any challenges that along the way where you thought, maybe this isn't for me, maybe I should change path? You know, what kind of kept you going and, you know, and get over those sort of doubts?
That's actually a really interesting question. And it was never for me a doubt about loving to do it, to do costume design. For me over the years, and it has happened to me twice in my career. So after having worked solely in theater for probably 10 or 12 years and very low budget theater and constant, like working back to back, I really questioned whether this was viable. Not that I didn't want to do it, but, you know, was this viable? And I applied for a Canada Council grant. And here in Canada, certainly in my youth, there was the invaluable contribution of public money to support artists. That's mm-hmm. becoming more and more, less and less.
So it's not
more and more difficult
to get that
ample money to do anything of significance. And that really is a shame, because it is, can be, you know, and again, compared to many other professions, I don't want to make this sound like, you know, violin strings, but, you know, it is a difficult life, because especially with the numbers of forms of entertainment that, you know, people can indulge in now these days. So I applied for a Canada Council grant, travel grant, and travel work grant, and the opportunity of going to the V&A for an extended period of time and photographing much of their dress collection. Mm. And Bath, at that time, it was a museum, but it wasn't quite as dedicated as it is now. And, you know, I still, that was 1983, I think, and, you know, I still use those photographs, you know, in a project or another. They really are invaluable. Mm-hmm. And the notion was also to see if it was viable to set up a costume bank here in Toronto, because it seemed kind of crazy to me that we were making these beautiful costumes and then it would be, you know, completely dependent on the theatre to maintain them. Often they weren't maintained. And so, you know, they were just being lost for future designers. And so I met a number of really fabulous people in that year. And I also had my son that year. Wow. So, you know, we
a busy year.
Yeah. And, you know, so as a wee baby, you know, we traveled around with him. And
you said wee baby. Have you got a bit of Scottish in your family at all?
Well, watching Muir, of course.
Well, actually, before I interviewed, my sister said, Muir, is she Scottish? And I said, no, she's from Canada. But then I was thinking about it before the interview. I was like, my friend from Scotland has got the second name Muir. I was like, I didn't realise it's a Scottish name.
Yeah, well,
I'm Scottish, I should know this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was great-grandfather, I think.
Okay. Oh, well, that's nice. You've got a Scottish connection.
In the area. But, you know, I mean, in Canada, you know, best friends, Edinburgh, Glasgow, you know, I mean, like...
that's where I grew up, Glasgow.
Yeah, if it's not immediate, Kate Dickey is Glaswegian. Yeah. She played the mother Kathleen in The Witch.
Okay.
You know, so I think that I realized after traveling and working in New York with Madeline Mines and in London at Stratford East, you know, I think that it was like a complete reboot. I was recharged. I was like, yes, this, you know, how could I not pursue this? Mm-hmm. And then I think that much later, after many, many, many more years, this is my 50th year of designing costumes,
wow,
which is insane.
Yeah, I did look online, it said you're in your, like, you've had a 30-year career, but maybe that was a slightly older article, I'm not sure, but yeah.
I started in 1975, that was the first year that I started designing costumes, so I think that that could have been like maybe film and television and not particularly also theatre, mm-hmm, you know, and I have found that, you know, things that are in the press are not always accurate.
Yeah, not always up to date, I guess.
Yeah, I think that I've always loved to cook. I've always loved to cook for friends and for family. And so there was a point in time where I went back to school, for chef school, and I thought, well, you know, I could certainly be happy with a cafe in the country. I could certainly be happy with this. Mm-hmm. I certainly wasn't into, you know, high pressure chef cooking, and I'm not a chef, I'm a cook. And so I took some time away from design for about a year, roughly, maybe a little less than a year. And again, I learned tons and I loved doing it, but it certainly wasn't a passion.
Okay.
And so I came back to design, and then shortly after that is I met Robert. So, you know, he is such an extraordinary leader and such an extraordinary talent, and he has combined such a wonderful group of people that, you know, it is certainly, you know, the recharging, the rebooting time is not the same in between projects with Robert as it was when I was doing films and certainly series work. It wasn't necessarily as gratifying, and it certainly wasn't as, you know, it was perhaps more, you know, it definitely was more stressful, you know, because if you're trying to produce things that are accurate, interesting, detailed, and that's not wanted, you know, if the idea is that's, you know, whatever, you know, whatever. Yeah, that's extremely frustrating and wearing on a, you know, on creative feelings. So I certainly have never felt that with Robert. If anything, I'm, you know, trying to meet the bar that he keeps raising.
That segues on perfectly onto like my next question, because I want to ask how you met Robert. And yeah, I mean, it really sounds like a perfect match. You know, your visions align really well. And considering you've worked on, I think, every single one of his films ever since, you know, The Witch. And I've also heard you're working on another one, which I'll talk about later a little bit. So yeah, how did that collaboration come about? And I'm assuming you just realised you both had similar artistic visions about things.
Well, Robert had written The Witch, and he knew Jaron and our editor, Louise Ford, from short films that he had done in New York. And I think that they were trying to find, you know, further financing and a place to shoot The Witch. And I think that, again, the stars aligned. And because of having access to north of Toronto, about 5 hours north of Toronto, woods that were suitable for shooting, you know, in terms of not being close to a town or something like that. You know, it was more remote. And also, I think probably financially, it behooved the production to come to Canada. So Robert interviewed in Toronto for a costume designer, set designer. So Craig Lathrop became the, because he's in Toronto as well, he became the production designer. I was hired as costume designer. And Tracy Loader, who is the makeup artist for Nosferatu and also The Witch and The Lighthouse, she didn't do the prosthetic makeup for Orlok, that's David White, but she was also hired at that point in time for The Witch. And so they all quite quickly left for Northern Ontario to start building the farm and the set of the meeting house. And so I insisted that I stay in Toronto, because that is where the body of people that I work with, cutters, tailors, dyers, breakdown artists, and I have an office studio in my house. And so really, I think that was kind of the beginning of how Robert and I have learned to communicate about these things, because he would return, for instance, to London to do more casting. And so we would, at that time, it was Skype, not Zoom. And so we would have these Skype conversations, and I would say, well, while you're in London, could you go to, you know, this rental house or that rental house and check out, you know, available rentals for the meeting house? And he would go and take pictures and send them to me. I mean, like, hello. Directors would do that. That relationship, you know, maybe it became quite clear that we were enjoyed working together, at least from my point of view, and it seemed quite simpatico. And then when we did The Lighthouse, it was a similar set of circumstances, because it was shot on the east coast of Canada. I stayed in Toronto, again, because the tailors are here, and knitters, and cap makers, and boot makers, and, you know, everyone else that I work with. And so, whereas for The Witch, Robert had to stay in Northern Ontario to oversee much of what was happening there. So he couldn't come to Toronto for the fittings when the cast arrived from the UK. And so we did that with photographs and Skype calls and things like that. So for The Lighthouse, it was really fabulous that he could come from the East Coast back to Toronto for the fittings with Willem and Rob Pattinson. In both cases, with The Witch and The Lighthouse, I finished after the fittings, I finished the costuming, and then we did the breakdown phase in Toronto, and then the witch was driven up north to Northern Ontario, and the lighthouse was driven out to the East Coast. And in both cases, that costuming arrived, and seeing it on the actors in situ, it was astonishing to see how, again, close Craig and I are, even though we're not working in the same place.
Yeah.
You know, we are communicating enough and well enough that it all seems of a kind. And what became clear as well is that Robert is our conduit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the main line. And so, you know, we are feeding that information and clarity and working toward the final images. And he is the one that is, you know, ratcheting up over here, turning down over there. So both of those long distance films, I think, set the stage for all of us getting to work together in Northern Ireland on The Northman.
Yeah.
And that was a blast. It was really hard. Obviously, COVID happened in the middle of it, and we all had to return to our, you know, corners and wait. And then we reconvened and had a bit more prep time and then started shooting. And mm-hmm. that was very clear that we were all developing a much larger canvas. The notoriety was larger,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, much larger cast. And then I think we honed the interpersonal skills of communicating those ideas. And then Nosferatu is the happy product of that.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a lot of other directors, you know, when they find their key crew almost, it's like when the team, because I live in France, actually, we have an expression. It's like, we don't change a team that works, sort of. That's the,
yes.
But I'm not saying it in French.
Yeah. Why fix it if it's broken?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, obviously you work,
you all.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, it sounds like, you know, he's found his sort of core team that he can work with throughout his whole sort of filmmaking career. We're just going to take a short break, as this is quite a long episode, so feel free to go and grab a drink, stretch your legs, or go run to the toilet if you need to, or preferably go and subscribe to this podcast. When we come back, we'll be diving straight back into Linda's approach to historical research when doing costume design. So I read that you go very, very deep into your research. You know, I'm sure you're reading books, going to museums, all sorts of things. So what historical references or inspirations did you draw from, in particular for Nosferatu? And can you share some insights into your research and sourcing process for Nosferatu and also your other films as well, your previous films?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so Robert Eggers, while he's thinking of these ideas for scripts, and certainly while he's writing, he is doing his own research well in advance of when we receive the script. And he is using these images and the research that he does to know and to embed in the script, you know, the accurate details of farm life or society at the period. And so when his collaborators start, we're gifted these lookbooks that have portraits or illustrations or whatever. Sometimes Robert has done his own, you know, drawings. And, you know, they're not necessarily only about location or about character. Sometimes they are atmosphere, or they are an adjective, you know, loneliness or love or whatever. So that for Robert's films is the starting point along with the script. And then it's incumbent on me to start elaborating on that research and find more and more and more information, because I'm the one that is, you know, will be designing each of the garments, whether it's boots or jewelry or underpinnings or bonnets or mentes or crazy, you know, Hungarian, Turkish influenced 300-year-old boots, you know, for Orlok. You know, all of these things are a part of the process. And so I've never found that it is particularly linear. It is a long and winding road. And I don't do all of one character at one time. And that's partly because I find it's a bit of overload. You know, to just keep reading and reading and reading and reading and reading about women's wear, mm-hmm. I might pull my hair out. And so we'll
take a break and move, look at something else.
Start reading about men's wear, mm-hmm. or even, you know, start looking at the folk costuming that is so important in the story of Nosferatu. Robert, he has the protagonist, certainly in The Northman and in Nosferatu, he encounters, Thomas Hutter in Nosferatu encounters these other cultures intentionally because it's, you know, kind of he's traveling through the Carpathians and he's uncomfortable and he doesn't know where he's going and he it's difficult and then he unlike in previous iterations where somehow he understands what the villagers are saying, and Robert, he's taken it quite literally that they are speaking a language that Hutter does not understand. So it's very confusing for him. He's the inside of the inn is tiny and close, and he's tall, and he keeps, you know, having to duck underneath things.
He's a complete outsider.
Yeah, there's a villager that is speaking Romanian, and she's, you know, like, don't go, and pray, and he doesn't know what she's saying. So all in that same vein, researching all the clothing for all of those characters, I don't read Romanian, Robert doesn't read Romanian, we had to find historians and film people that actually, you know, could read Romanian and could impart the history and the authenticity to us. And then again, the puzzle pieces, you know, they keep adding up and you kind of go, okay, I get it. I understand. Oh, okay. And also in Robert's script, he will say, you know, generally that Hutter is traveling through the Carpathians and encounters these people, but we have to pinpoint where that is because as I've been doing my research, I have found that each of the counties in Romania have quite different, you know, there are slightly similar things, but there are also very, very different things. Mm-hmm. And so I have to say to Robert, you know, okay, so now's the time we have to decide in the Northman, where is Olga's birch forest? You know, because the very intricate hand embroidery is different mm-hmm. in this area than it is in this area. In the case of the Nosferatu, it was, we have to pinpoint, we chose Hunedoara County. And that meant very specific headdresses, very specific footwear, very specific embroidery, and then so design all that and then have it made. And you're always working to a budget, which is interesting. You know, you people throughout the years that I've been doing this, more with contemporary thing, because obviously you can't go to the Hunedoara store 1838 and buy that costume. But with contemporary costuming, you know, I often have people say, oh, your job must be so much fun. And you think, no. It's
tricky. There's a lot of logistics, I can imagine, because I was just one of my questions as well was how do you go about making that decision between buying a costume or making it or renting? You know, maybe those costumes already exist in an archive or a costume institute, so you could already have it. Or do you think, or at what point do you think, well, actually, I'm going to have to take something and create it from scratch entirely, or reinvent something that already exists?
This completely depends on the budget. Starting with The Northman, because it was a larger budget, and then with Nosferatu, I had the blessing to be able to travel from, in the case of The Northman, it was from Belfast, in the case of Nosferatu, it was from Prague, to the UK, so London, and then to Madrid, and then to Italy, so Rome, Prato, and Florence area, and look in those areas. What we were looking for were textiles, because they have in Prato outside of Florence massive sort of wholesalers, jobbers, that sort of thing, but with really amazing number. Obviously, prior to COVID, London, England had many more textile shops than, you know, many closed down during COVID, which is really sad. And so the other prong of the two prongs would be looking for potential rentals. Actually, it's three prongs. So looking for textiles, looking in the rental houses for rentals. For Robert's films, he is so specific about the year and about the place. And with, for instance, the Viking film, reality, like authenticity, researched authenticity as opposed to fantastical, imaginary, beautiful, but not necessarily accurate costuming. And so it means there's very little to rent always. Mm-hmm. And so the third prong would be looking for makers, milliners. I had, while I was at a costume rental shop in Rome on the Northman. I had been to a few places and I was like, oh my God, we have all of these Berserker headpieces that we have to make, and they're bear or they are wolf. And there were 10 of them, and they were very realistic, and they were very, so a couple places I found a wolf headpiece, but it looked more like, you know, something you'd give your 3-year-old.
Yeah, you don't find those everywhere, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Not terrifying at all. And again, it's crazy to me how, because I keep asking and speaking with people, and I'm interested in, you know, wow, that's really crazy. And I'll ask about something, and that conversation will lead away from what I was asking about, but it will lead to what I need to know. And in that instance, I was introduced, or I was given a couple of phone numbers, and it was a sculptor and a furrier that worked together in Rome, and they had done another costume that was completely different. But again, through an assistant who spoke Italian, we connected with the furrier and the sculptor, and they ended up being the people who sculpted the heads of the bears and the wolves and the furrier that you, and I ordered, I had to find the materials from Canada. And so that was all shipped to Rome. And then the furrier was the person who actually did all of the incredible. And then I chose in a tiny little antique shop in Rome, in the Campo di Fiori. I found these glass beads that we use, some of them for the eyes, in the wolf heads. And so, you know, it goes all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy, the amount of detail, the amount of hours that must go into all of that. I can't even imagine. But I can see why people can see it as fun. I mean, it does sound fun. I spoke to the costume supervisor from Barbie, and she told me how much shopping they get to do, and I thought, that sounds like so much fun, like I'm really good at that. But also, I guess
you're
good
at it. You're good at it until you
it's a job.
It's Christmas Eve and you're buying presents from people that you don't really know that well.
That is a great analysis. I'm not good at buying presents for people, so actually, yeah, that maybe that.
I don't want to make it sound like it isn't fun. Oh my God, I feel so fortunate to be able to do what I love.
Yeah.
Like, it really is incredible. But it doesn't mean that it isn't stupid hard.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's difficult. And, you know, sometimes people just see the glamorous and the fun side of things, but actually it takes as much work as anything else. And I guess you've got to have your eyes and your ears everywhere, because, you know, for you to be out and about traveling and then to spot, you know, those particular jewels that are going to work with that particular headpiece. I mean, yeah, I guess you're not going out with like a shopping list of everything you need, or maybe you are sometimes, but you know in your head.
No, I'm going out with,
it's all up in your head.
I've done, for Nosferatu, when I arrived in Prague, when we actually carried through and finished the film, I arrived in Prague with all of Ellen's character designed, with the exception of, I think the wedding dress was maybe, I knew it what I wanted to do, but it wasn't complete yet. And all of Anna and Hutter and Orlok. So then I still had to do Harding and Sievers, and, you know, I had done Sievers and I had done Von Franz before I left for Prague. So there was a very brief period of time in Prague, meeting the Czech team, and then I left with my assistants to on this crazy, and again, people sort of say, you know, oh, that must be so much fun to go to Madrid, and da, da, da. It is grueling. You end up Ryanair flight that's been cancelled twice, and you end up, you know, in an airport outside of London at 3 a.m.
Oh God.
Driving to your hotel, and you have to be at 6 to fit, you know, another character. So it's
hard work.
Pressurized, sure.
Especially throwing travel into the mix as well, which is never, not always a straightforward. There's delays and cancellations, as you say, and then if all that happens, you've still got to go work to work the next day. So
exactly, and it's a different, not just different currency in every country within 2 weeks. It's a different,
the time zone.
Different plugs, different, you know.
Oh, everything, yeah. Time zone, the plugs, everything. Languages, changes, yeah.
Well, but one other thing I was going to say, just about, you know, the shopping list. So the shopping list is in my head, and I try to give a download to my assistants to say, you know, heads up, we're looking for this, we're looking for this, we're looking for this. But it's those happy conversations that lead to, oh, I know, you know, this milliner. And so, for instance, in Rome, we had a local contact costumer, Mari, who was extraordinary, and her sensibility was just amazing. And she took such delight in the project that she had two friends who were had been her friends for a very long time, and they were two sisters, Grevy sisters, who they make hats, and so they are part of a family that have made hats since I think the late 1800s, and they have outside of Florence in the hills a small factory that has the original chimney, and they have all of the original equipment, and it was just so educative to be there and to see these photographs on the wall of straw boaters on sticks all over their front courtyard drying in the sun. Right? Wow. Like they from the 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s. And they were very talented women, but they hadn't quite had the opportunity to do, other than a few Roman operas, they hadn't had the opportunity to do millinery for film. And so we gave them crowd hats to work on, and they learned a ton, you know. And that same person knew a silk flower maker, and she was on the other side of Florence and in a tiny town, and she made all of the individual silk lilacs that are in Lily Rose's bridal veil. And you know, like, so again, it's just mentioning these things, talking to people, being open to what the people who you are working with, what they are like, and what they offer, and, you know, trying to just be open.
I mean, definitely, yeah, having your eyes and your ears open at all times, and having a great, you know, contact book as well, of people, knowing all, you know, having a good network of people in the industry as well seems really useful. I've got a few little questions to ask about Nosferatu in particular. I mean, what I love about your costumes is that they do look so lived in and used, and I know that maybe it doesn't sound like a compliment, but it is. It's a compliment. You know, they don't look like brand new pristine costumes, and, you know, like from a Disney movie, for example, you know, they do look like they belong there. And I'm wondering how you get that sort of used look for certain costumes, you know, maybe the cloak of Orlok, for example, or the shoes, how they, yeah, they look like they've lived a billion lives kind of thing before, you know, being on that character. How do you do that?
Well, for Nosferatu, I think it was probably Harding and Frederick Harding and Anna Harding and their two children. I think those are probably the only costumes that really didn't have any aging hands on them.
I was going to say, yeah, they do look the most, pristine.
They are up to the minute. I have a million of these sort of thing. Whereas all the other costuming, it went from gentle wear to 300 years of corpseifying. And Orlok's costume, we approached it from the point of view of a rotting corpse putrefying bag of putridness.
Oh, lovely.
On the inside, so how does that rotting body affect the textiles on the inside? And then how does that, the textiles that are rotting on the inside affect the threads on the outside of the fabric, as does the environment that it is exposed to for 300 years. So you've got breakdown happening on both sides of the costume, which is making it, you know, react in a certain way. And we crushed all of the buttons, for instance, at the back of the dolman, which is the garment that is worn under the overcoat, which is called a mente, thinking that, you know, Orlok would have been on his back for a good deal of that time, and you know, so the things had been affected. And thinking about it from the point of view of character, but more importantly and most challenging of breakdown, and one of the most challenging parts of working with Robert and Jaron is the lighting. You know, the lighting in Robert's films, they are natural sources and augmented, you know, with lighting, but with filters, heavily filtered. The lighthouse was in black and white. Nosferatu was also further, the color was further degraded in post. So I am constantly checking with our DP, Jaron, about levels. And, you know, you might have two windows that are lit with moonlight coming in through those windows, but Lily Rose is seated between those windows against a wall in nightlight and candlelight. And so the challenge is to figure out what kind of textiles to use, what colors. I used a lot of pale colors. I used a lot of fabrics that had metallic threads. So Orlok, for instance, has a lot of gold threads throughout his costuming in order to reflect backlight, in order to be able to to see silhouettes in order to be able to see the inner layers that are not underneath, but are at a deeper level than the mente, which is the most forward of the garments, on his body. So, and that is really through accruing the knowledge through more than one film and really asking questions. And I can't stress this enough, that I would say never feel afraid of sounding stupid or sounding uneducated or sounding naive, because, what is stupid is not asking the questions. And so that's what we do. We ask questions and we talk together. And, the DP doesn't know about costuming or necessarily the wall treatments for the sets. And hopefully, he's learning in that process, and that will stay with him. And then, it's a trading that information between all departments constantly.
Definitely. Yeah, because as you say, it's better to ask the question then and feel silly about it maybe for a second, but then wait until it goes into post and it's like, oh, you can see through her dress, or that looks awful, or you can't even see the outline of that gown, or whatever it is, something that's rather than wait till it's too late.
And it's interesting that you mentioned see through the costume. So for instance, Lily Rose, who plays Ellen Hutter, she spends quite a bit of the center section of the film in a nightgown, or a nightgown with a corset on top of it. And so that nightgown is not just one nightgown. That nightgown, back in the research phase, I found a manual that was written by a lady in 1838, and it's attributed to a lady, and it's called The Workwoman's Guide to, and I'm going to paraphrase, absolutely everything that you would need to make for your household. And that is literally a manual that's that thick. And sections on foundation wear, men's shirts, nightgowns. And so from that manual, I could arrive at patterns. And so Anna's more a wealthier character. So she has two different styles, and they both have a lot more fabric, much more embellishment. And Ellen's nightgown, because she has a more modest means, is the same silhouette throughout. But in that manual, I discovered that a household would buy bulk fabrics, cottons or linens, and then make six.
The same thing.
Yeah. So she could have, in reality, she could have the same nightgown. And, the audience doesn't necessarily know that, but they know that there is some feeling of reality in this, and that's because it is real.
Sounds like people were so much more self-sufficient back then. I could definitely not sew six nightgowns by myself, which is, I'm ashamed to say. I can sew on a button, but that's about it.
Yeah, so we used the beautiful, fabulous cutter for The Witch, Brenda Clark, who I've worked with many, many times over the years and is a friend. She and I used to joke about, William, the father, was such a bad farmer, and the corn was all rotting, and, they didn't have enough food. And I said, what if Catherine was also a really bad seamstress? Children were all walking around with armholes that didn't quite
work. Too short.
Exactly. So that nightgown, we arrive at what the brief is for that nightgown, and then the idea. And then I thought, okay, so this nightgown is going to be seen in a number of different sets of circumstances, and one of them is rain. We don't want this to be like a wet t-shirt contest. We don't want Lily Rose's body overpowering as beautiful as it may be. We want the emotion of the scene to be what is playing
at the center.
And so we had a fit model come, and we did mock-ups, twirls of the nightgowns in different weights, and we soaked her.
Fun for that model. As long as the water wasn't too cold.
She knew what was coming, and she was, sport about it. So then we also have moonlight, which is very different than interior candle, multiple candlelight. Mm-hmm. And so, that was a different weight. But they all have to look like the same nightgown. They have to behave and read as the same nightgown, but they are of different weights. And the nightgown that you see the mature Ellen in, so not the nightgown she's wearing in the very first scene as a teen, that was totally different. But then the first time that we see her as a young woman waking up, young bride, full of promise, love, just everything. everything that is positive for a brief moment in the film. That nightgown is the most diaphanous, lightest weight, sheerest, most sensual, closest to the eye. Mm-hmm. You can see her skin through it, but all of the structure, the pattern pieces are the same in each of the nightgowns. It's just that the weights are different.
Interesting. Another thing I noticed as well in Nosferatu in particular, and probably in the other films as well, but more focusing on Nosferatu, is that there's so much movement in Nosferatu, and I wonder how you go about making the costumes in such a way where they can, I guess, be flexible with all the movement, with all of Ellen's, I guess you can call it, convulsions and shaking and and then, horse riding as well. And then also there's a moment where she rips, one of her dresses open, the brown dress. How do you go about making the costumes to work for movement and, potentially being ruined as well?
Well, we have, to address the being ruined, we have multiples. And so I try to practice economy because, we have a larger budget, but it's not endless. And so I think, okay, this young woman is not at home. She has packed a trunk. She's gone to her husband's friend's home. Mm-hmm. So she has a limited number of pieces. And so in the plot, because I do obviously plot everything, mm-hmm. the dress that she wears when she is at the beach, and it's the second time they're at the waterfront, and she's covered with that beautiful big green and cream shawl when she's in the wheelchair, and then she's convulsing and the shawl's gone and she's in down and dirty in the mud, in water, that would make sense. But since we have to do multiples of that, it would make sense to also have that be the dress that she wears when she returns from the Harding house to the Hutter house, and then that whole scene where she's telling the truth to Hutter, and that builds and builds, and then she is in and out of possession, in and out of communing with Orlok and speaking that, you never satisfied me as he did, and trying to tear free of this possession, if you like. And so because of the way the dresses are made at the period, the skirts take a huge amount of yardage, and the bodices are always constructed in pretty much the same pattern pieces. It's the sleeves and the embellishment that varies. So you always have the princess line, you always have the center front seam, you typically have the opening up the back, sometimes it's buttons, sometimes it's hook and eye, sometimes you have a tight forearm, and the gigot sleeve sits lower on the shoulder line at this point. So, there were things that were an advantage, and so I made the decision, so the brown dress will play in those two instances, and we will do enough to offset, it wouldn't just be the dress, to try to help have it not be obvious that something's going to happen to this dress, right? This isn't the stunt dress, do you know what I mean? And so because of the construction, it's a center front seam, and we piped that seam, so we didn't pipe every center front seam, but mm-hmm. we piped that center front seam to make it easier for Lily Rose to get her fingers in. It was pre-set, so it was hand-stitched with a single thread, as opposed to, very tight hand-stitching that is meant to not come apart. Mm-hmm. This was very light stitching so that it could be broken quite easily. We did more bodices than we did skirts, and the bodices we were stitching back together at the time where Lily Rose was having a moment and composing herself to do another take, and the hair and makeup had to, do their touches. Mm-hmm. So we had three bodices perhaps, so that we could restitch and have it ready. I think we did 30 takes of that scene, for instance. Wow. And it was a benefit that the silk that I used for that dress was a stripe. Robert had wanted a stripe somewhere in that range of clothing, and so that seemed the best place to use the stripe. It was a watered silk, so there was a bit of a kind of, impression anyway, and it was not a solid flat color, so it was easier to use. I think we had, and I also said this, so this is another way a costume designer can really affect the way things play out. I said to Robert, okay, we have this scene, and the way that it was initially written, Lily Rose's character was always in the frame. The Hardings carry on down the beach, but she's always in the frame. And I said, if they turn back and find her, we can have her already in the water. If she's always in the scene, we need a lot of multiples.
Yeah.
It's going to cost a lot. Do we want to spend the money there? And so Robert wisely wrote it in such a way that it was, she's dry in the wheelchair, cut to the Hardings. They have their intimate moment. Lily Rose is in one of the two, because we have two skirts, mm-hmm. a clean skirt and a potentially wet skirt, attached to the bodice, and we turn back and she's already in the water. So as a costume designer, you really have to go through the material and figure out, without reducing the impact of the scene, without limiting the potential for the director, you have to figure out where it is you can affect the cost and also the amount of work that the workroom is going to be doing, because these are really labor-intensive garments. They take a very long time to make. The sleeves, oh my goodness me, Frances Sweeney, our lead women's wear cutter. I mean, she's as into research as I am, and we always have worked with Frances a number of times now, and we always have a lovely time sitting down and figuring out dress by dress, you know, whether it's a Viking outfit or whether it's a 1838 woman's outfit, you know, what are the lining fabrics? What are the, you know, where are we pleating? Where are we binding? Where are we piping? What are the closures? Whatever. Women, the children's wear was a delight to do as well. And those huge beach cloaks, the mantles that are worn in those scenes on the beach, we were calling those beach architecture, because, you know, Robert would say, there's nothing else. There are the crosses initially, but you know what? The costumes are the set, so they can be,
you know, make an impression. How do you personally see the role of women evolving in costume design and in the film industry at large? How do you see that evolving in the future? Have you seen changes over the time, you know, your, I guess, you know, 30 plus years career in costume design?
I think that absolutely there's been a change. I think it's primarily come from costumers, women costumers, and also male costumers, understanding that the way that we present ourselves has to be also a huge part of the change. So for instance, I'm very adamant that we don't have girls in our department because we don't hire children. People, and it's not that people necessarily mean to demean by saying my girls or the girls, but it is demeaning. And therefore, and I do think that semantics actually count. So that would be one of the most vocal ways of changing things. Insisting that you're paid properly. And that is very difficult, I think, because often we want the experience. But if you're constantly asked to do things for free or virtually for free or kind of for free, then that isn't really sustainable. And nor is it changeable if you don't change it. You know, so, and guilds and unions have certainly helped with that. I was just in Los Angeles for the Costume Designers Guild Awards this past week, and I was, and that is not a community, the Los Angeles community is not a costume community that I am particularly aware of, because, you know, that's not where I work. I was absolutely blown away by the camaraderie and the lifting up, you know, elevating the department and the designers within the department, and the you know, striving for equal pay for equal work. So, you know, yes, I mean, things have changed, but, you know, I mean, we know this. We know that the role of women, it's always a slog. It's demanding that the relevance of the costume design position be recognized. There's a bit of the attitude, well, everybody gets dressed, how hard can it be? You know, and that is truly ignorant in the sense of not knowing, like ignorant as in not understanding, you know, the real facts. So I think that it's kind of incumbent on costumers of all genders to be vocal, and not necessarily combative vocal, just educative vocal. And, you know, try to approach it. I think if one presents oneself as a colleague and an equal, it is much more difficult to be relegated to a backseat.
I mean, that sort of ties into my next question, because I was going to ask what your advice would be to other young women wanting to break into the costume design world, whether that be theatre or film and TV like you've been able to do. Do you have any advice from your own experience and the own lessons you've kind of learned along the way?
Yes, I think I mentioned earlier would be, you know, a very important one. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Try, I think, not, when you do ask your questions, I think it's really great if you can find a way to ask the question straightforwardly without, you know, making it, oh, I'm so sorry, or, you know, don't demean yourself by making it sound silly before you even ask the question. Just ask the question.
Yeah, ask unapologetically and be confident in asking your questions as well.
Exactly. And I would say dress appropriately. If one wants to be taken seriously, then dress professionally. If What else? Let me think. Read. Don't just read, you know, read fiction for sure, because that is one vein. Nonfiction is another vein. Film scripts are out there and they're available. You know, you can find them online. You can find them at libraries. You don't need to purchase all this stuff. I think listen to interviews. People do speak about the things that they do and that they hold near and dear. Listen to music. Go to theater. Go to art galleries. Go to costume collections. Try to see, and when you look at runway shows, I found it incredible actually just recently on the Dior, I think it's the Dior Spring runway, and Ariana Grande wore this to the Critics' Choice Awards. So there was a dress that has a petticoat. I think it's a wired petticoat. It's all open, so you can see the structure. And I think it's just been done before, but this is a beautiful iteration of it. I mean, you know, hello, we had to do this for Nosferatu. You know, any period thing has this underpinning in it. Three or four models down the runway, there was a dress that could quite have easily been Glenda's dress, or, you know, the skirt part.
Yeah.
You know, folds, not tulle, but, you know, some kind of very stiff, structured. And most bizarrely, I recently saw boots on the runway. They might have been Balenciaga. And they are, so it's like a Doc Marten. And if you can imagine, if they took the toe and bent it straight up, that is exactly the silhouette of the Hunedoorian footwear for men and women in Nosferatu. And I sent it to Robert and I said, Hunedoora, who knew? And he said, I saw those and I didn't even think about Hunedoora.
That was actually one of the questions I wanted to ask earlier, and I was wondering, have you seen, like, I read something about Nosferatu core, like, sort of making its way into mainstream fashion. Have you noticed the influence off of the fashion in your film, sort of, and going into...
I can't say that I've noticed it specifically from Nosferatu. I mean, goth is goth, and, you know, Victoriana, fingerless gloves, how fabulous and sexy are they? You know, corsets. I do know that both Emma Corrin and Lily Rose Depp, ambassador for Chanel and Miu Miu, you know, they both were in fittings saying, I'd wear this.
Yeah.
In terms of all of the black for Lily Rose's a morning outfit, you know, all of her underpinnings were black. And so, you know, and Emma had the most beautiful pair of black fingerless gloves. And she had there was a design for Emma that I actually saw in a painting. And it was a ring that is attached to this beautiful bracelet with a very, very tiny, fragile gold chain. And, you know, I mean, I haven't seen that out there in the world, but probably we will.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'll see it sort of, yeah, you'll trickle down
that.
Into...
I honestly can't say that I've seen things, and I have had lots of people ask on the Instagram comments, you know, what is the fabric for this? What is the fabric for that? You know, I can certainly talk forever about the experience of making these things and researching these things, but I'm not going to say where the fabrics come from, because that is really kind of like you're really recreating something that should just be the costume for the film. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that was very singular, specific, mm-hmm. And I would say to anyone who is either a reenactor or an aficionado, you know, do your own thing. Like, really, seriously, just do your own thing and have fun with it.
Yeah. I mean, while you're delving so much into the past for your costumes, you're mentioning there, you know, different collections from Dior and things like that. Are you also looking a lot at the present and the collections that are coming out as well in the future, like in reading fashion magazines and even looking at street style?
While researching Nosferatu?
Just in general for your films and your... Yeah, no, just in general for research for your work.
Yeah. I'm a person on the planet, so for sure. I mean, you know, I have friends who kind of poo-poo pop culture, and they don't want to watch TV, and they don't want to watch this. And I think, you know what? It's a part of your life. It's a part of the time you live in. You don't have to like it. You don't have to want to emulate it, but you might want to know about it. So for sure, I am aware of what's out there. I don't necessarily, I certainly wouldn't buy. I took the decision, it'd be interesting to see if I can stand by it for the whole time. But, you know, because I've had to do a lot of trips to New York, Los Angeles. This week I'm going to the BAFTAs, and then it's the Oscars. So, you know, not quite as often as am I asked. I'm asked more about, you know, the research process and the costuming, but I'm also asked, you know, who or what am I wearing to these various events? And it's very daunting because it's all very, very, very expensive. And I look at a price tag of, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And I think, how many trees could I plant, you know, at our place in the country for that amount of money? And is that a responsible attitude? People aren't going to be looking at me and what I'm wearing. They're going to be looking at the movie stars because they look great and everything. And they are a better model for that, you know. So I've tried to stay true to myself and think something that is wonderful and that I'm comfortable in and that I can wear again, that I love, you know, that is maybe a little more expensive than I would have perhaps bought, but, you know, not outrageously so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have time to ask a question. I was going to ask about, like, sustainability and costume design, but, I mean,
well,
yeah.
We have an advantage over construction, for instance, and set, because, you know, our costuming can be reused. Sets are torn apart, and, you know, very, you know, people do try to save what can be reused, flatage and things like that. But, you know, sustainability is definitely in front of mind for me. You know, reusing crowd costuming, you can use certain things and then add your own layer, you know, in the witch. We had rentals because we couldn't have afforded to make all of the crowd costuming for the meeting house, but we did make all the coifs, all of the aprons, all the falling bands, all the collars and cuffs. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is something that you really notice. And so that was a way of putting a personal stamp on that for that film. You know, and I donated all of that to the costume house that helped us, you know, with the crowd costuming. So that can be reused in, you know, for quite a sizable period, you know, like a number of years period. I don't buy multiple types of fabric for the same outfit. I buy what I need for that outfit. And that is true and has always been true for me for contemporary costuming as well. There may be more than one outfit that would be suitable for a scene with a character, but I try to think of what the best look would be and buy that and fit that and have an actor and a director agree that that's fabulous, then have a rack of clothing that we go into a fitting with for just one outfit and then take it all back. And I totally disagree. Sometimes there is the notion that you can actually use the garments and then return them. And it makes me furious, because what that does with contemporary sources, stores, and people who are trying to make a living, you know, it burns the goodwill, those outlets. And so I really encourage people not to do that. Like, I know people who have reticketing machines, and you think, what? Like, that's just it. That's irresponsible.
Yeah, and when you're costuming so many different people, yeah, you've got to find a way to make it as sustainable as possible, I guess, as well. But also, I guess, there's an opportunity for it to, as you say, be donated or even be displayed in museums, collections, exhibitions, yes, or even for students to study. I suppose there's a way for it to be repurposed.
I still would love, and it's just because it's been so crazy in between these films, I still would love to be able to help organize and achieve costume donations to Viking museums of some of the costuming from the Northmen, because what I became very aware of in dealing with Neil Price and the various other very dedicated historians that we dealt with on the Northmen is that museums have next to no money to actually mount. You know, I there was very exciting while we were working on the Northmen. Now, grave number, and I'm going to just say it's Burka 851. I don't even remember, but anyways, female warrior. It's the grave of the female warrior and shield maiden. She's often called a shield maiden. Mm-hmm. And the DNA testing came back while we were doing the Northmen, and it was conclusively proven that she was a female. She had been a female person. And that was pretty thrilling because it had been debated for a very long time. And there was a museum, I think it might have been in Uppsala, but I could be mistaken. They did a recreation of what they felt that her clothing might have been like. And so that really made me start to think about, and also Neil's reaction when he came into our costume workshop and he saw the amount of authentic looking or hopefully authentic looking, because again, it's almost impossible to know that, the amount of clothing that was being made. And all he could think about was, you know, how long it takes just to get one small display up for you know, a museum audience. happens.
Well, for the last question, what is next for you, and what projects are you excited about for the future?
Well, I am starting to read and buy books, medieval books that are around 1300 AD. I can't really talk about the project yet, but you know, it is the next Robert Eggers film, and it's a terrific script and exciting.
Very excited. I'm excited to see it whenever that comes out. And do you have four or five top films for costume design? Your top four or five films?
Orlando would definitely be one, because Orlando, the book, the Virginia Woolf book, Orlando, was a favorite of mine from the time I was about 16. So Santa Claus costuming for Orlando is definitely one of the list. But I'm going to have to think about that.
No worries. It's usually a difficult one for people to pick their top five films of anything. I'm the same. I have all these films that I love, and then if you put me on the spot, mind goes blank. So
exactly. Well, also, just specifically costuming is kind of like, I mean, I have tons of really, you know, favorite films, but you know, and also the way that they're shot really affects the costuming as well, right? There's an amazing film called The Anchoress, mm-hmm. which is a Belgian film, and I've loved that film since the first time I saw it, and it's shot in black and white. Pete Postlethwaite is one of the lead characters. It's a crazy story, and it's the script and it's the performances that have also informed my admiration for the costuming.
Of course. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It has been so interesting. I've loved hearing about your career and your costumes and all, just everything. I could probably talk about it for hours, but we can't unfortunately do it for much longer probably. And I wish you all the best at the BAFTAs on Sunday, next Sunday, and also at the Oscars in March. And yeah, I'm sure you'll have a great time. Lots of celebrating.
I appreciate your podcast. Your thank you. Style is lovely and very easy to talk with.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you.
That's a wrap on today's episode of The Real Girls Club. A huge thank you to Linda Muir for sharing her insights and giving us a behind-the-scenes look at the world of costume design. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and follow us on Instagram at Real Girls Club for more interviews with the incredible women shaping cinema. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time for another deep dive into the magic of filmmaking through the eyes of the women who make it happen. Thank you.